You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Hello and welcome to this podcast, Managing Gastroesophageal Junction and Gastric Cancers in the Community Setting. I'm Dr. Richard Dunn, and I'm pleased to be joined by Dr. Rahul Gosain, who is director of the Wilmot Cancer Institute in Webster, New York, a community practice. In this podcast, we will get Dr. Gosain's insight as a community oncologist of sequencing therapy for patients with advanced gastric cancer, discuss which patient populations may benefit from anti-angiogenic therapy as second-line treatment, and also discuss the management of toxicity from these therapies. Welcome, Dr. Gosain. Hoping that maybe you can introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your practice.
Dr. Dunn, thank you so much for having me. I look forward to our discussion. As you've mentioned, I am a medical director, medical oncologist here in Webster, Rochester, New York with Wilmot Cancer Center. I'm a general medical oncologist, and I've joined this practice just over last year. Prior to this, I was again in community settings as a general medical oncologist.
It's a pleasure to have you today. Some will know you as the host of the widely popular podcast, The Oncology Brothers. So it's great to be getting to ask you the questions today and not the other way around. So today, wanted to get your insight on treating advanced gastric cancer in the community. Could you share your general approach to treating patients with advanced gastric cancer? And really, if you could describe the greatest barriers or challenges that you may face in treating this population in the community.
Yeah, I think to start off with, not just gastric or GE junction, as a general medical oncologist, I think one of the biggest challenges that we face is how fast this field is moving. You mentioned our podcast, Oncology Brothers. That's been the idea, that this field is moving so fast, and how can we bridge the gap between academia and with us in the community? So gastric cancer or GE junction is not any different. Just over the last year or two, we've seen so much happen in the space, from immunotherapy to combination of immunotherapy, chemotherapy, and anti-HER2 agents, all in upfront settings. So I think that just keeping up with that data, but also knowing when to collaborate or when to reach out to tertiary coronary center, I think is very important. Not everyone is in this unique good position as I am. I can text you, Dr. Dunn, because we work in the same institution, saying, hey, this is what I'm doing. Can you reassure this is the right track? Or what would you do differently? Is there any clinical trial? We all can appreciate that this is an aggressive disease. And from get-go, clinical trials and having the right management is very important.
Can you discuss how you might overcome multidisciplinary challenges, like getting input from surgery, palliative care, gastroenterology, nutrition, et cetera? You kind of alluded to how you might tackle this problem in an institution, but maybe for those that may not be as lucky to be ingratiated in a tertiary care center, how, in your experience, how best to go about trying to bring all the teams together for really the central goal, which is the benefit of the patient sitting in front of you?
Yeah, and the reason why that is important, we've all talked about that the outcomes in rural settings are not as good as urban settings. And that could be because of multiple different reasons. Is it the tumor biology? Is it because we don't have multi-D discussions or whatnot? But at least as a practicing physician, I think the onus is on us to keep up with the data and to make sure we're providing the best care for our patients. Here, we do have set up where we have disease-specific tumor board. But in my previous work environment, we had a general tumor board, which is attended by a general medical oncologist, a general radiation oncologist, and at times a trained GI colorectal surgeon, or at times just a general surgeon. So having those discussions there, I think, is important. But the other thing that has served me well personally is just reaching out, even if the patient's not traveling to a tertiary coronary center, just networking, either texting, email, saying, hey, I'm dealing with this patient. Can I just quickly review this patient with you? Would you consider surgery? Is this even a surgical candidate? Is there a role of induction chemotherapy? Or this is truly metastatic and now just move forward with systemic treatment? I think those are some of the important discussions that happen offline.
Yeah, I think it's worth mentioning the NCCN guidelines recommends that, you know, these patients are cared for in a way where their course is presented in a multidisciplinary tumor board. Now, whether it's uber specialized, like you might have in academic setting, or broken down to just medical, radiation oncologist, surgeon, I think meeting together, now these days it's usually virtual, but kind of meeting face to face, hashing through challenges, problems, you know, where it may not be straightforward, to build a consensus in how patients are treated is really the best way forward. And it gives an opportunity to discuss the data, evidence, or things that might be emerging as newer treatment strategies. I wonder, you know, what, in your view, how do you stay, and especially as a general oncologist, where you have to be knowledgeable of so many different tumor types, what is the best way to keep up to date? Is it referencing the NCCN guidelines? Is it going to meetings like ASCO? Is it consuming CME material that's available on the web or virtually? What are the best, other than your podcast, what are really the best ways of trying to stay up on emerging treatment strategies?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of all that you've mentioned. Even right now, when I'm seeing patients in my clinic, I have 10 different tabs open with NCCN guidelines. Every now and then I'll refer to ESMO guidelines, ASCO guidelines. So I think relying on that. Nowadays, we've also integrated these systems where pathways where you can at least use your EMR to guide a few things. What has helped me personally is attending these meetings, focusing on CME discussions, and just learning from the local tertiary coronary centers like you. When I was not here, I was reaching out to Wilmont saying, how would you treat this? And it gives us a chance saying, okay, I can do this locally. Or every now and then when the patient's seeking a second, third opinion and they bring back home a different thought, opinion, or recommendation, I think that, again, reaching out to that recommending physician is important, saying, what's the thought process and how can I improve my practice? Because at the end of the day, like you've mentioned, the goal is, let's make sure that our patients are getting the best treatment close to home.
I think, you know, as a gastrointestinal medical oncologist, and just talking with people about the treatment of patients with these types of malignancies, people are really sick. And I think there's, to a certain degree, there's a degree of nihilism out there about, well, how helpful is second or third line treatment in pancreatic or gastroesophageal cancer? Should we be offering second and third line treatment to patients with advanced gastroesophageal cancers, or should we be talking about best supportive care? In your practice, do you see patients benefit from second line treatment strategies that we have available for advanced gastric cancer? And how do you identify patients who progress on the first line, you know, who may be candidates for further therapy? What sort of things are you looking at in the chart, discussing with patients when thinking, all right, what do we have next? What could benefit them most?
Yeah, I think the bigger thing here ends up being patient-centered care discussion, right? Our goal as medical oncologists is to deliver that data and help patients make that decision. That similar improvement of OS or PFS might mean very different things to a patient that's 40, 45 versus someone who is elderly and is 80, 85 and wants to focus on quality of life. So I think that when you say that second line treatment and what the benefit is, the goal is, let's talk about that to our patients and have those discussions. Is that benefit versus the side effects that come along with our second line treatment options, which are limited right now, is it worth it? And when we're looking at second line treatment options, we did not have much. TDXD just got approved in the second line space. If you're HER2 positive, we have been using ramucirumab now for some time. As a general medical oncologist, even before it got approved here in gastric GE junction space, it was actually a year or two approved before that in lung cancer. So we have been a little comfortable using that drug. I started off by saying one of the biggest challenges is just keeping up with so much that's happening in this field. But the same thing is, it gives us an edge because now we're able to use same drug for different indications. We saw that for immunotherapy. Immunotherapy is now being widely used for lymphoma, but we've been using it for melanoma and lung cancer for years now. Same thing for ramucirumab. We've been using it for lung cancer and gastric cancer. So I think that overlap really helps us and manage some of the toxicities and gives us a little more comfort in using these agents.
Do you see any role or future of combining anti-angiogenic strategies with immunotherapy? Like, you're well aware of the patients you treat with GU cancers, lung cancers, and such. How do we kind of marry these two approaches? Is there a role for this in the future in your mind?
Yeah, so one data set that comes to my mind was not this ASCO, not 2023, but in 2022, there was a data presented for lung cancer where patients that had progressed on initial chemo or chemoimmunotherapy were then exposed to immunotherapy with ramucirumab. And it was a phase two data, and that looks really good. The discussant at that time, a year and a half ago, had made the comment at the podium that this is practice changing. I think that that's a little early because that was phase two data. The phase three study is ongoing, and we're actually enrolling for that study here at Wilmot. So I think that, can we start combining immunotherapy and anti-angiogenesis agent? The answer is yes. We still have to wait for a longer, more robust data. I would like to hope that that is the case. We also know from recent presentation at ASCO in renal cell by Dr. Shuari, where they had given immunotherapy, and then in second line, patients were again exposed to immunotherapy, and there was no benefit whatsoever. So I really think that combination studies in second line for immunotherapy are exciting, and we just need to find the right mix and the right patient population.
In terms of second-line treatment, you alluded to trastuzumab, deruxtecan earlier. For a HER2-positive patient, you have both options of trastuzumab, deruxtecan, and paclitaxel and ramucirumab. In your HER2-negative patients, for you, is it taxol, ramucirumab, is what you're recommending for most patients? Are you thinking about some using ramucirumab alone? Does fulfirine ramucirumab enter into the conversation? Or are there certain situations where you feel like you have to avoid anti-angiogenesis agents and just go with chemo alone?
Yeah, I think when we're having those discussions, as you've mentioned, when it's HER2, my go-to right now is T-DXd, but that's a small subset of patient population. The most are HER2 new negative. And in that settings, ramucirumab monotherapy also had benefit. And the patients that have concern for neuropathy or marginal performance status, I do discuss monotherapy. If they don't have any contraindications, then I lean towards a combination. Then FOLFIRI with ramucirumab, we have a little more experience from colorectal side of things with that. So every now and then I've brought that up in a scenario where I cannot give paclitaxel, commonly because of neuropathy, because they were exposed to oxaliplatin. So I've talked about that. So I think that all those options are available as a discussion and sharing what next ends up being a common discussion. Though this field, again, is changing with potentially something coming up with Claudin 18.2. So we'll see how that looks like.
So for your patients that are getting chemotherapy and potentially ramucirumab in the second line, how are you monitoring these patients and how are you managing their toxicity?
Yeah, so the common toxicities, again, the ones that we tend to see, same thing with lung cancer and here, because the combination is very similar in lung. We're joining this with docetaxel here. It's paclitaxel. The common side effects that we run into, of course, diarrhea, hypertension that we can see with ramucirumab, with paclitaxel, ends up being neuropathy. I often, not just with this agent, but just my practice ends up being whenever I'm switching treatment, I tend to see these patients for that first cycle. And then thereafter, I am alternating these patients between myself and APP. And the important part is I have to make sure that my team, which is my APP, my nurse, the infusion nurses, are all in tune with all these new advances, side effects, and supportive care for these options.
How do you impart that knowledge to the team, right? So, you know, you're intimately aware of the data and the safety data in these phase three trials. You're going to meetings. How does that knowledge get imparted to the rest of the team?
Again, one place where I think community or general medical oncologists often have an edge. I happen to know my infusion team a lot more intimately than someone who's working at a bigger center and you have 60, 70 chairs and you don't know which nurse will be taking care of this patient. Often at our center in Webster, a core group of 6-7 nurses. So every now and then, at least once a month, we sit down, talk about the new data saying, hey, this is what's going on. This is what's approved. You got to look out for infusion reactions for certain new drugs. Whereas when it comes to like medications like TDXD, you have to be very mindful because these nurses are the ones that are spending more time with our patients. So when I'm going in and out with a busy clinic and now the patient reports, hey, I have this mild cough lingering and I'm on TDXD, this is something they should be saying, well, should we really give this drug? So I really think that in the community with our core group, it makes that dissemination of education a little easier.
As the pharmacist get integrated in the community center with either managing toxicity or patient education?
So we don't have a pharmacist on site here, but offsite they're reviewing all the labs, but they're not actively seeing these patients. So they do rely on our team to communicate this back and forth. At my previous center, we did have a pharmacist on site. But again, I think that's a unique setting. Most of private community general medical oncologists might not have a pharmacist on site, and they're just relying either on the images or the labs rather than talking to the patients. I think it is a little easier when they're on oral drugs because we have the system in place where they'll call and follow up on these patients. But when they're getting treatment at an infusion center, the responsibility ends up being of our team to make sure we're teaching and educating the patient. We're keeping our team informed and making sure at the end of the day that the patient's educated.
These settings are so variable in terms of the resources that are available. And I think, you know, hearing from you today about how you think about treating these really complex patients in the community, it's really insightful. And, you know, I think even as those of us working in a large academic center, I think there's a lot we can learn from that. The last question I want to ask you is, we've alluded to little bits and pieces here in terms of kind of new options for patients, IO in the first line, the, you know, positive phase three data at using drugs that target Claudin 18.2, HER2 targeted therapies, both in the first and second line. And we've had other drugs approved kind of later line therapies in gastroesophageal cancer, like drugs like Lonsurf. Regorafenib is not FDA approved, but there was a positive study with the INTEGRATE trial, and there'll be another trial coming out looking at regorafenib alone or in combination with IO. So, you know, with all of these things kind of coming at you in terms of new options for patients, how do you put it all together? How do you think about, I want to sequence the therapies, and there's no right answer to this, but like kind of taking a step back, how do you think about sequencing all of these therapies available to you to really maximize the best outcomes?
Keeping in mind what's important to the patient, side effects, outcomes, I think that's important. But whenever we're treating, I really think we all are playing a game of chess, saying every single move counts. And we want to make sure we're not burning bridges for any of these drugs. Example being, if someone's on FOLFOX with neuropathy or severe neuropathy, am I going to be able to give them paclitaxel as my second line or not? So I think that whenever we're using first line, second line, we're always thinking about what next in the back of our mind. And at the end of the day, this is a devastating disease. We need to do better in terms of outcomes, and hoping we'll continue to advance this field with small increments. But I really think every single time I see a patient with metastatic disease. We share that, hey, these are our options. Let's make sure we're keeping what's important to you in mind, and we're balancing the side effects and the benefit of each every single treatment here.
I think those are important words to practice by, right? I think if we keep the patient, their goals and their wishes at the center of what we do, I don't think you can go wrong. And so that's all the time we have. But I want to thank Dr. Gosain for sharing his insights and experience with us regarding the use of anti-angiogenic therapies and therapies in general for the treatment of advanced gastroesophageal junction and advanced gastric cancers, and especially providing the insight of how we treat these complex patients in the community. And thank you for joining us. And we hope you'll listen to another episode of this series. This podcast was brought to you by Med Learning Group. Med Learning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. And I want to give a special thank you to our supporter, Eli Lilly, who provided an unrestricted educational grant for this activity. Take care, everybody. Thank you.